Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famiel-Linner. Next week, film fans will make their way to Columbia to attend the Citizen James Film Festival. The annual event, which takes place this year from October 4th through the 6th, features the work of female filmmakers. One of the filmmakers attending this year will be Tia Lesson. Her documentary Citizen Coke tracks the influence of money in contemporary politics. The film starts with the Citizens United Supreme Court decision of 2010, which removes certain restrictions on corporate political donations. The film then moves on to the recent political showdown in Wisconsin, shortly after Governor Scott Walker pushed a string of conservative reforms, such as curbing collective bargaining rights for public workers. Today on Intersection, we'll talk to the co-director of Citizen Coke and others about the issues her film brings up, the rules surrounding money in politics, the influence that money has, and what it all means for our democracy. Joining me in studio, Paula Elias is the director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us by phone, Tia Lesson is the co-director of the film Citizen Coke. Tia, thanks for calling in.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's a professor in the MU School of Law who specializes in campaign finance law and democracy theory. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. And we'd also love to hear from you and our audience as well. Do you think money plays too big a role in modern politics? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925, or you could email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at intersectkbia. Okay, so to start off, Tia, we'll talk a lot more about this film, but first off, why did you decide to make this film, Citizen Coke?
Well, I think, you know, everybody in this country was alarmed and stunned by the infusion of cash the last couple of years in the post-Citizens United world of campaign spending. And we wanted to take a look at how that money was impacting, in particular, the citizen recall of Scott Walker, and whether money, you know, big money, would play a role in whether he would, you know, win or lose that recall. So we set out to really document the decision itself, Citizens United, and the impact of that decision.
Okay. And I guess, Paula, having seen this film, why did you decide to include it in Citizen Jane this year?
Well, we love Tia. She was our first director of our first opening night ever of Citizen Jane. I think it's an incredible film, and I think just the way that it approaches such a complex subject, something that's so complicated, and really is able to tell the story and the full breadth of the story in a way that is really understandable and is also engaging from a storytelling point of view, it makes it a remarkable film, and we had to have it.
Right. And Tia, yeah, the point Paul is making there, I mean, this is a really complex issue, right? So how did you go about trying to make that relatable and I guess just consumable in this film?
Well, first of all, we, you know, Carl Deal, my partner in crime here, and I really wanted to, first of all, understand the Citizens United decision. There's a lot of rhetoric about it. There are a lot of bumper sticker slogans. But we wanted to, you know, just really understand what it was, how it came about, and what it meant. And so that's where we begin the film. We try to make it relatable. We tell the story of how how it got to the Supreme Court and how the Supreme Court had some ethical conflicts of interest over that decision. And then we take it to the state level to see how it plays a role and how money in politics in general plays a role there in Wisconsin. So that's how we lead you into the story. Hopefully, in the story, we have you meet some of the characters in the film, lifelong Republicans, actually, people who have voted with their party, who are committed to their party, but are really at odds with their Tea Party-elected governor, Scott Walker, who has, after he's elected, has gone on an attack against the public employee unions and working people in the state. And we're really interested to see how these people who have long felt represented by their party, you know, all of a sudden feel betrayed and decide to take some action.
And Richard, I wonder your thoughts. As Tia mentioned, one of the starting points of this film is that Citizens United ruling in 2010. Could you tell us a little bit, some background on that, and I guess how that has, if that's changed the political landscape a little bit since 2010 when that was implemented?
Well, there's no question that it has changed the political landscape. The real question, and the question that that Tia's film is going to begin to help us answer, is just exactly how. What the Supreme Court did in the Citizens United case, most people have heard, or at least you know those who are paying attention have heard that the Supreme Court said that basically corporations are like people, and there can't be any restrictions on their campaign financial interests. Well, that's a bit of an overstatement. That's a little overbroad, and so let me just explain what they did by giving you just a little bit of history, and I'll try to keep it tight. In a very big case, the United States Supreme Court upheld the ability of Congress to regulate campaign finance. It was a very important law. This was back in the early 1970s, and it was in response to Watergate and concerns about corruption in government. And in a case called Buckley versus Vallejo, not signed by any individual justice, signed by the court itself, the court upheld the validity of that law in substantial part. What I mean by this is this: the Supreme Court created a distinction between campaign contributions, in other words, money that you or I might actually give to a candidate or their campaign, and what they called independent expenditures, in other words, money that I might spend at a printer to pay for flyers for your campaign, or you know today money that I might give to a radio station or pay to a radio station or a TV station to put on ads, and what the Supreme Court told us is that it's okay for Congress to regulate because it is certainly reasonable to have concerns about corruption in politics. And it's certainly reasonable to have concern about the appearance of corruption in politics. And so that was the first big step, was they upheld the act. But what they said was when it comes to campaign contributions, that's okay to regulate. But when it comes to independent expenditures, in other words, money that we might spend on our own behalf, you know, out of our own pocket to just you know, help someone's campaign or ballot measure, they said money is speech, and that would be an invalid restraint on political speech. And that's the most precious kind of speech that we have in a democracy, is our ability to speak on political issues. So the Supreme Court, big decision, says you can have limitations on campaign contributions, but you can't have limitations on independent expenditures. Well, what a lot of states did after that, it actually followed some federal laws. What they did was they said, look, when it comes to corporations, and it includes not just big business, but also labor unions and other associations like that, when it comes to them, you know, they have so much money that we're going to make them pay for their political contributions only out of money that they collect for the purpose of making expenditures. In other words, Exxon Oil can't spend, under this was the thinking in the states, Exxon and Oil can't spend the billions of dollars that it makes every year on political contributions or political expenditures. But what they can do is they can form a political action committee, raise money from certain people for that committee, and then use that money to spend on behalf of candidates and ballot measures. And it was that rule, it was that principle that the Supreme Court said they can't do.
Okay. And Tia, I guess, what did your film find in relation to a lot of what we just heard from Robert?
Well, you know, we looked at Wisconsin was one of those states which, after a Citizens United decision, lifted its ban on corporate contributions and really unleashed incredible amount of political spending, mostly to pay for broadcast ads on television and on radio, which I think are largely responsible for the campaign arms race. In a lot of countries, in a lot of European countries, candidates don't have to pay for airtime. They get that for free, and a lot of other countries also limit the amount of time that candidates can actually campaign to 3 weeks in some places, 5 weeks in others. You know, imagine how great that would be. In Wisconsin, after the Citizens United decision, the midterm election saw the election of Scott Walker in the end of 2010, and his campaign benefited from a huge amount of campaign money that came from third parties, from the Republican Governors Association, which was largely funded by Charles and David Koch, and from corporate PACs and other special interest groups, and a lot of those were out of state forces. These were not folks in the state of Wisconsin who were, you know, trying to elect a Walker. They were folks from out of state. So we were curious about the impact of that money and what we realized that Scott Walker's attacks very shortly after his election on labor unions had very little to do with Walker's trying to curb the cost of state spending, and it had a lot more to do with undercutting union clout and neutralizing small dollar donations from working people, which labor unions amass and spend collectively. So we were curious about how this ploy, this maneuver, this strategy, it looked like on the part of Scott Walker and many in the GOP and the extreme right of the GOP, was being deployed. And Wisconsin was a great case study for that. So in other words, the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision unleashed all these corporate donations and at the same time, super enfranchising the wealthiest, they wanted the wealthiest not only wanted to take advantage of this decision, but also cripple the opponents that were largely funding the Democrats, and that would be labor unions. And so what we came to understand was that Scott Walker's attacks on the labor movement and on public employee unions was simply a way to undercut the spending of the largest political organizations supporting doing third-party expenditures on behalf of his opponents, the National Education Association, Service Employees International Union, and AFSCME, among others.
Okay. I'm going to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the changing role of money in politics. That's the topic of the documentary Citizen Coke, which is showing at next month's Citizen Jane Film Festival in Columbia. Joining us in studio, Paula Lelias is the co-director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Joining us by phone, Tia Lesson is the co-director of the film Citizen Coke. And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's a professor in the MU School of Law. And for you and our audience, what's your opinion of the Citizens United decision? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. I guess, Richard and Tia, One thing I saw argued in a New York Times editorial talking about the Citizens United decision was the fact that prior to the decision, donors still had ways to – these big donors still had ways to get their money in. It does free things up a little bit, but you could indirectly contribute to a campaign through things like social welfare groups or 527s. Could you talk a little bit about how significant Citizens United is in light of these other paths that still used to exist?
Well, let me go ahead and respond to that by saying that money in politics is a lot like water. You know, it will find a way. And what the Citizens United case did was it made it a lot easier. There were a lot fewer hoops to jump through. And it also created the potential for much larger aggregations of campaign resources, the so-called super PACs that we saw that were so powerful in the last election. And it was simply because the limitations that were on corporations at the state level and to a lesser degree at the federal level simply did not exist anymore. They could use all of the money that they had in their treasury, every last dollar of it, if they wanted to spend on for political purposes. That's what was new.
And Tia, I guess to that same thought, I know a lot of your film focuses on the Koch brothers, but others that are these large funders. Do you think that Citizens United really was the breaking point, or are there other factors at play too?
Well, you know, after Citizens United, as Robert pointed out, a lot of the states followed suit and lifted their longstanding bans on corporate contributions. But not only their bans on corporate contributions, their disclosure requirements for nonprofits and for political donations from corporate interests and from individuals. And so those disclosure requirements might have been actually tightened on the federal level through super PACs, but on the state level, they weren't worth the paper they were written on. I mean, those laws were either revoked or the attorneys generals in those states decided not to enforce them anymore. And so you had states that, one, lifted those bans and had no either the laws requiring reporting from corporate interests didn't exist or they weren't really robust enough to deal with the flood of money that was coming in. So I think it really had a major impact. Look, there's a ton of spending out there, and there was a ton of spending, you know, beforehand, and there's certainly ways to hide that spending. But there were many places where voters could easily figure out either immediately or within a few months where that money was flowing from. In today's America, billionaires and corporate interests can very easily hide their money through nonprofits and spend in unlimited fashion. So I think it's pretty much a sea change in from what I gathered, and certainly on the state level.
Okay.
And if I can just follow up on that yeah. briefly, I think T is absolutely right, and it's significant because the Supreme Court is not done. They're going to be hearing a case next week, which is going to be testing the constitutionality of contribution limits. All we've been talking about with Citizens United are limitations or the invalidity of limitations on independent expenditures. The next step is whether Congress can limit whether states can limit political contributions and. The case next month is McCutcheon versus FCC, and it's going to just chip away at that. And I think most people who follow this know that where the Supreme Court really is heading is toward a system of disclosure only. In other words, no regulation and disclosure only. And I think very serious questions can be raised about whether that is in any way adequate.
And Tia...
And we saw in Missouri, I mean, Crossroads GPS had two ways of donating, you know, money into elections or spending money in elections, and one was through their nonprofit and one was through their super PAC. And if you wanted to disclose your contribution, if you were a corporate interest or a billionaire, you could pick, you know, one of those two. And if you didn't want to disclose, you know, you could go through the nonprofit. And, you know, the money is spent either way, but you can hide your trail. We were sort of stunned when we interviewed Floyd Abrams, who is one of the preeminent First Amendment lawyers who actually defended Citizens United and the group and in front of the Supreme Court. And we asked him, will corporations one day just be able to donate directly in an unlimited way to candidates? And his answer to that question, which we have in the film, is yes, that the logic of Citizens United, if it were applied to direct contributions, you know, would invalidate those bans and those limitations. And so that's exactly what Floyd Abrams said, and I think that spells disaster for democracy.
Well, then let me concretize this if I can, or if you need to move on. But
okay, go ahead.
The case that is coming up that's going to be argued next week, in McCutcheon, it tests in a very technical way. It tests how much any one person, including now corporations, can give to a candidate. Currently, the total aggregation limit would be $48,000, if the aggregation limit is lifted because of the operation of other rules, the amount would be $3.6 million. And so, if any corporation, if you or I wanted to cut a check for $3.6 million, if the Supreme Court rules against the contribution limit, there won't be any problem. There aren't that many people out there who can cut that check.
Right. I do need to take a moment to remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're talking about the changing role of money in politics. That's the topic of the documentary Citizen Coke, which is showing at next month's Citizen Jane Festival in Columbia. Joining us in studio, Paula Elias is the co-director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Joining us by phone, Tia Lesson is the co-director of the film Citizen Coke. And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's a professor in the MU School of Law. We'd love to hear from you and our audience as well. Do you plan on attending the Citizen Jane Film Festival this year? What films do you plan to see? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at @intersectkbia. So, Tia, I had one other question, too. In your film, one of the other subjects we see a lot is a man named Buddy Romer. Could you tell us a little about him and why you included him in your film?
Yeah, Buddy Romer is a former governor and U.S. representative from Louisiana. He was a Reagan Democrat when he served in the Congress, but switched parties. In other words, he voted for Reagan, but switched parties in about 20 years ago. We followed him on the presidential race as he tried to compete for the Republican presidential nomination. He is a banker and committed to taking special interest money out of elections. He was fascinating to us because he was on this sort of quixotic quest to limit his campaign monies to small dollar donations. I think it was $100 limitation. And he was trying his best to compete with the rest of them that were getting, you know, these millions and tens of millions and into their campaigns. And, you know, he was taking this very principled stand on the national stage, but we were sort of captivated with him as a character. He was, you know, he had the political chops to be a contender. He was charming, he was funny, but ultimately he was outspent and he was drowned out by his opponents. And so it's sort of, we really follow him just trying to not only get on the ballots, but get on the very debate stage that the rest of them were speaking on. And time and time again, he failed, not because he didn't have important things to say, not because his voice wasn't an interesting part of the conversation, or because he was very serious about running, but because he simply hadn't raised enough money to earn the right to be on the debate stage. So we intercut Buddy's journey, journey with Buddy throughout the film, because we're trying to remind ourselves and that this is happening on the national level as well as happening there in the state of Wisconsin. Okay. This influx of money in politics determining not only who wins oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes and most of the time who wins, but who even gets to speak in the first place and who gets to have their voices amplified. Those choices are predetermined by who gets the big money in their races.
Okay. It's the same thing with film. I mean, as everybody's talking, it's so interesting to me that...
And Paula, you've been sitting here so patiently.
Well,
yes.
No, it's exactly the same thing because, I mean, only 9% of the top 250 grossing films were made by women last year. So that means basically everything you see at the multiplex was directed by a man. Mm-hmm. It's about having a voice, whether it's with politics or influencing culture or, you know, it's really money talks and it's really what influences, and it's getting worse and worse all the time.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the other roadblocks you run into? I mean, what makes it so difficult and what could, I guess, free things up a little bit?
Well, I mean, I think it's not so much laws, it's the way people act, and Tia probably has some thoughts on this as well, but I think it's access to resource. It's the good old boys club. It's, you know, we work with who we know. I think there's some sexism there that we tend to trust men more with big budgets.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you work with who you know. So if it's always been this way, you tend to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's, you know, and documentary is a little bit different. I mean, women are much, much more well represented in documentary, but, you know, don't even get me started on narrative films. It's very difficult. And I think it's about people having a voice and being able to influence how we think and how we vote and the kinds of things we do. And so it's not just politics.
Right. And yeah, Paula, we have a little over a minute left before the break. So what else are we looking forward to this year at Citizen Jane? We're talking a lot about Citizen Coke and this higher brow politics conversation. What else are you looking forward to this year?
And it's a great film and there are still tickets. So people should definitely get to see the film. We're looking forward to everything. I mean, we actually have double the number of narratives or fiction films of any year in Citizen Jane. So we're really excited about that. We've got comedies and we've got documentary. We've got our opening night film is incredible. It's Maiden Trip, and it's about 14-year-old Laura Decker who sailed around the world by herself. So, you know, it's a big, great weekend full of incredible films. Citizen Coke is one of many, many great films that we're really proud to bring to Columbia.
And you also have a summit coming up, is that
we
right?
Do, we do. The Citizen Jane Summit, that's Thursday from 3 to 7 at the historic Senior Hall on Stevens Campus. And basically it came out of, we have these conversations where we're talking about why are women so poorly represented behind and in front of the camera, and what can we do to change it? And these conversations naturally start going towards strategies to try to fix it. And so we finally decided, let's formalize it, and we've got all these amazing thinkers, amazing women, let's bring them all together and start really talking about it. So we have Yvonne Welbin and Julia Reichert and Melissa Silverstein and some graduates from MU School of Journalism, actually, the founders of the Riveter magazine. And then we're going to have just a heavy audience participation kind of a day where we really talk about how can we make this change. Because I think you see a film like Citizen Coke and you leave just feeling like, oh, gosh, you know, I need to do something. And that's how we feel about women in film and being able to have our voice.
Well, we do have to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the changing role of money in politics. That's the topic of the documentary Citizen Coke, which is showing at next month's Citizen Jane Film Festival in Columbia. Joining us in studio, Paula Elias is the director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Joining us by phone, Tia Lesson is the co-director of the film Citizen Coke. And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's an MU Law School professor. I'm Ryan Femielner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Tumuliner, and today we're talking about the changing role of money in politics. That's the topic of the documentary Citizen Coke, which is showing at next month's Citizen Jane Film Festival in Columbia. Joining us in studio, Paula Elias is the co-director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Joining us by phone, Tia Lesson is the co-director of the film Citizen Coke. And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's a professor in the MU School of Law. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience today. Please give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia, or you could join our online chat. Okay, so coming back to the issue we skipped across as we wanted to talk about Citizen Jane, since that's coming up. But Richard, I think I heard you ready to jump in on Tia's thoughts as we went into the break. I wanted to give you a chance to jump back in there on what she was talking about, the role of money in politics, again, being the issue we were talking about.
Yeah, the point that I was going to make is that the real issue here in some respects is a principle that the Supreme Court has repeatedly reaffirmed, and that is that it offends the First Amendment to in any way equalize speech, and when it comes to political speech. And so this is the reason that the Supreme Court, particularly led by Justice Kennedy, who's a very influential member of that court, this is really the reason that the court has adopted this approach. It's very much of a black and white, colorblind kind of an approach. It suggests that all people are created equal. Now I'm including corporations and trade associations, and the reality of that, as we know in so many different contexts, simply is not true. The response that you'll get from those who support this, including Floyd Abrams, who is a First Amendment absolutist, you know, there are no exceptions in his view. The argument that you'll hear is, well, you still have every right to speak. The problem is being heard. When somebody else is spending, you know, $3.6 million to have their voice heard, and you've got 1,000, you are not going to be heard, as you know, your voice will simply be drowned out. And so this is without question the direction that the Supreme Court is heading, not just with independent expenditures, but also campaign contributions. In other words, throughout, you know, for the entirety of campaign finance, they just don't believe that Congress Congress should have the ability to regulate this kind of speech. And so I look forward, just looking in my crystal ball, when we have people like Tia doing the important work that they're doing, and Paula giving it the proper air that it needs, my hope is that we'll see a constitutional amendment proposed in the states, within the next decade or so, once people realize what has happened.
And Tia, it's a good time to bring up an interesting background on how your film came to be, talking about The Voice and also where it was going to air. There was a little bit of a hiccup. I doubt that's the right word you would use. Could you explain a little bit about how the funding situation went and some of the things you learned from that experience?
Sure. Well, you know, we've been filming for about a year or so when we approached public television with a pitch for a film, and we were looking to get funding and a broadcast partnership for our film, which at that time was called Citizen Corp. And we actually got the great news last April of 2012, that we got the green light from public television executives. They loved the film that we were making. They saw work samples. They saw cuts of it. They saw written proposals. And they were hoping, they were not only committed to giving us $150,000 in funding, but also hopefully a broadcast slot on one of the big series that airs independent documentaries like ours.
for 2014. So we were working with them in partnership with them, and we were on track for public broadcast until this agency withdrew its financial support and its partnership for our film. And we were stunned by this, and it became clear why they had done this. Initially, they first asked us or made some demands that we take the word Coke out of the title of our film. Then they asked us to scrub some of the content, so it was de-emphasize the role of the Cokes in the film, these billionaire industrialists who are spending $400 million in the last election cycle and largely helped to bankroll Scott Walker. They were entirely relevant to the story that we were telling, and they also personified the big money in politics, both the money of individual billionaires and also corporate interests, because they own this corporation called Coke Industries. So we were open to changing the title, frankly, and we were certainly open to making changes in the film. But then we realized where these demands were coming from public television executives. It turned out that David Koch, one of the Koch brothers, was on the board of two of the largest PBS affiliates in the country, WNET in New York and WGBH in Boston. And not only that, he had made large contributions to both his affiliates and to public television as a whole. And apparently, WNET took offense to a program that had been aired earlier that was critical of David Koch and threatened the public agency that was funding our film. And after that, they started to get very nervous, and then they withdrew their support. This is all documented in an article written by one of the foremost investigative journalists of our time, Jane Mayer, and in the New Yorker magazine. And what she discovered was that David Koch was on the verge of making a 6- or 7-figure donation to WNET when all hell broke loose and WNET threatened this public agency, and then, you know, we started to get pushback on our film. So we were sort of stunned by all this. We had counted on these funds, and we had also counted on the public television broadcast for the film. And while we were having these conversations about their editorial demands, they were also saying things like, we love the film. We think it's a terrific film, and we can't wait, you know, when we want to fight for the broadcast. The problem is there's people with power, and they have power, and we have to essentially placate them. And we thought this wasn't right. We certainly were happy to make changes to the film, but we thought that we couldn't, with integrity, make changes because of fear of a powerful donor to PBS. It just seemed wrong. So we spoke out. We told this investigative journalist, and as a result, we lost our ability to get this on public television. Probably burned that bridge. But we educated the public about the very big power, the oversized influence that big money has, even on our public media. We all know the power that big money has in our elections and our public discourse, but we didn't realize that it could even shape, you know, the editorial and programming decisions on public television.
Sure. And in that article, from what I've seen on reporting on this, to be fair, that it sounds like that it hasn't been documented that there was any actual request from David Koch to have this change. It may have even been a case of self-censorship, from what I understand.
That's right. Well, yeah. In fact, that's even worse. I mean, in some ways, it was even sort of more disheartening to know that that these public servants, these people who are getting public monies to fund and curate documentaries, took it upon themselves to censor our film because they were trying to make a broadcast partner happy, a broadcast partner who was cultivating a large donation from David Koch. So in some ways it's worse. You know, that's kind of the problem with big money in politics. You know, these politicians don't need to get phone calls, you know, from corporate interests. They don't need to get direct threats. All they need to know is where the money's coming from. And then, you know, we fear that their agenda is in part shaped, not they're not responsive to the agenda of the voters. They're responsive to the agenda of the funders. And that's why this big money in politics and in media is destructive.
Okay. Actually, we just have a comment from a guest I wanted to bring on. I think it probably is one of Paula's responses here. So the comment from the guest says that looking forward to Citizen Jane. Previously have seen some quite thought-provoking films. Women-led films nearly always stay with me longer than other types of films. Would very much like to see Forbidden Voices from and the shorts.
Yeah, Forbidden Voices is going to be really incredible. I got to see that down in Florida, and it's an amazing film about Yanni Sanchez, blogger from Cuba, and as well as a woman from Iran and a woman from China, and working within a government where they're trying to speak out and they're getting shut down. And, you know, it's interesting. We think about those as being pretty strict kind of governments around free speech. But apparently it's kind of here too. Just in a different way. But yeah, Forbidden Voices is a great film.
Okay. We also have a comment from Lodi. Actually, first I wanted to mention that we just brought on a new guest. Denise Lieberman is a senior attorney at the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. She's based in St. Louis, and she follows some of these issues on the state and national level. Denise, thanks for joining us by Skype this afternoon. Denise, you there?
Yes, thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. Well, yeah, I'll bring on this next comment, and Richard, you're on Skype as well. So this comment came from Lottie in the chat room. She said, the well-funded minority drowns out the majority. Thomas Jefferson said, democracy is cumbersome, slow, and inefficient, but in due time the voice of the people will be heard and their latent wisdom will prevail. Says, unfortunately, that's not true any longer since the average citizen does not think for himself or herself. I wonder, maybe Denise, that's a good time to bring you in and maybe talk a little about some of the research you've seen and what who gets a voice in democracy right now in the U.S.
All right, well, that's an excellent point. The concern that we have with the American Legislative Council and the contributions of the Koch brothers is that it eviscerates our traditional understanding of how democracy works, that indeed our lawmakers are responding to concerns of their constituents, concerns of things that are happening in their communities, and they're crafting legislation to be responsive to those concerns. And that is not necessarily the case. The Koch's influence through the Legislative Exchange Council crafts model legislation outside of the state of Missouri, outside of local interests, and farms those into the state. And we see this happening all over the country.
Right. And Richard, I wonder your thoughts on that, too. We haven't really talked about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, much yet. But, yeah, talk a little about the role they have in forming legislation. You mentioned earlier the state levels where we see a lot of the impact of this big money.
I think there's real reason for concern right now, given the disparity of power in being able to get one's message out, and you know this is really where democracy gets distorted. The fundamental idea, of course, is that all of us participate through our elected representatives at the state level, at the local level, at the national level, and if really they're not listening to us, then we don't really have democracy. I'm not exactly sure what we've got, but it's not democracy, and so I think it's really important, starting at the national level, but certainly working its way up for people to, you know, educate themselves and to insist that media outlets like this, give time to alternative voices. The problem is that with the monetary spigots open, it's very difficult for those who have alternative views to be able to fund their presentation. And so this is a challenge for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Denise, maybe you can take a step back for us here and tell us a little bit more about ALEC, because we kind of jumped into that really quickly for people who may not be familiar with ALEC and some of the work that it does.
Sure. Well, the prominence of the American Legislative Exchange Council really came there after the 2010 midterm election, when conservative majorities took over legislatures around the country, making it much easier for the organization to focus its legislative agenda. But in fact, the American Legislative Exchange Council has been around since the 1970s. And they describe themselves as a public-private membership association of state legislators that is funded significantly by its corporate members. In particular, the Koch brothers. Charles Koch sits on ALEC's corporate board. And the Koch brothers have given billions of dollars to the American Legislative Exchange Council. And the key way that this works is that the corporate interests and lawmakers sit down together and craft legislation that they want to see promoted. But the reality is that the corporate interests on ALEC's board have veto power, and they meet in secret prior to presenting their legislative agenda to lawmakers, and indeed sort of take the bill writing obligations away from these lawmakers, present them with model legislation that they've decided will advance their interests, and through a variety of incentives, strongly encourage those legislators to push that legislation through in the state. And one major example of this is the sudden proliferation of voter ID restrictions in states following the 2010 midterm election, where you saw some 38 states come to the table with photo ID bills that were nearly identical. And this was not a coincidence. This was not something that was happening organically in the states in response to reports of widespread voter impersonation fraud. Rather, this was model legislation that was being farmed out by the American Legislative Exchange Council and promoted by their state members.
And what are some other examples of the type of legislation ALEC has been trying to spread throughout states? Richard, maybe you can help us with this as well.
Well, I'll jump in here. I mean, the quote-unquote right-to-work legislation that eliminates collective bargaining for public employees and really curtails the rights of working people to bargain over wages and to bargain over safe working conditions and to really sustain and their own unions. And to contribute to local candidates, and those that right to work legislation is being passed in every state house around. In Michigan, a month after Barack Obama won the presidential election, that right to work legislation was championed in Michigan of all places, the birthplace of the UAW, and they won. And the group, in addition to ALEC, the group that also helped to champion that legislation was Americans for Prosperity, which is a political organizing nonprofit of the Koch brothers.
I need to take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Femuelner, and today we're talking about the changing role of money in politics. That's the topic of the documentary Citizen Koch, which is showing at next month's Citizen Jane Film Festival in Columbia. Joining us in studio, Paula Elias is the director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival. Joining us by phone, you just heard from Tia Lesson, the co-director of the film Citizen Koch. And joining us by Skype is Richard Rubin. He's a professor in the MU School of Law. And on the phone, Denise Lieberman is the senior attorney at the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. For you and our audience, do you think there should be campaign contribution limits in Missouri? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet at @intersectkbia. That is one thing we haven't... go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just want to add something. This is Tia again. You know, what really struck us when we were on the ground in Wisconsin filming, you know, this is not a partisan issue. This is really a transpartisan issue. And what we were struck by was a widespread protest that Governor Walker had provoked. These are not just union members, and these were certainly not just Democrats. It was a groundswell of citizens from both local parties and independents as well, and also non-voters who felt that Walker was betraying Wisconsin's legacy of Democratic values. So, you know, really, though the Republican Party seems to be benefiting right now the most from the Citizens United decision, it's really extremists and the wealthiest who are really seeking to gain from this.
Right. And Denise or Richard, feel free to jump in on this, but do you expect the right to work bills and voter ID, which we've been talking about, do you expect those ALEC-driven bills to come back up next year?
I absolutely do, and I look for more. I don't know exactly what they might be. Denise is closer to the ground than I am, but as long as they have the money and power to promote that legislation, it certainly sets the agenda. This is the advantage of having all the cards, and that's why I think it's really, really incumbent upon the media. I think it's incumbent upon citizens to arm themselves with more information and to work together to make those voices heard.
We have a comment from the chat room that reflects that. Says true democracy requires participation, requires in all caps.
That's absolutely right, and I'm going to echo Professor Rubin's response. We could most certainly expect to see legislation for representing ALEC's agenda come up next year. We already expect to see a cumbersome voter ID bill, as well as a proposed ballot initiative that would change our Constitution to obliterate provisions of our voting rights to come up in 2014. And, you know, I think that most citizens, most voters, most Missourians would probably be surprised to learn that the legislative process was being usurped in this way, that it would be sort of so easily bought and paid for. Many of us probably are cynics and know that big money plays a role in our politics, but I don't think people expect that outsiders are actually writing the legislation that is driving a primary agenda here in Missouri. I think it goes against what most Missourians feel is the right way for democracy to work. People are offended by the idea that politicians can manipulate the system for their gain, and even more so, that private interests can do so behind the scenes. And that's the concern with what is happening here.
Yeah, we have a comment to that effect from Artie in the chat room as well, saying lawmakers do not craft legislation, lobbyists craft it. Lawmakers just push it through at lobbyist bidding. Lobbyists are all about excluding people, not including. But these organizations we're talking about, legally, they get that are in control of all this money, that the money is being donated from many times these large donors. There aren't many restrictions. There's really no oversight when it comes down to it. Tia, I know that comes up in your film, and Richard and Denise, it's something you guys are talking about on a regular basis as well.
Well, and the American Legislative Exchange Council doesn't even present itself as a lobbyist. I mean, at least if we were doing that, there would be something that was upfront about it. Their agenda would be out there. We know where they stand. But in fact, many of the contributions that they're making to their members come through the sort of so-called charitable scholarship funds. Much of their agenda setting is done in private, behind closed doors. They don't promote themselves as actual lobbyists. Rather, they go through the legislative members to promote this agenda sort of on the fly in the dark.
And to be clear, the Supreme Court is tacitly endorsing this process by interpreting the Constitution in a way that the Supreme Court never has in the past. In the past, the Supreme Court has historically upheld the kinds of limitations that the Roberts Court is striking down. So, you know, you have to understand that this is a product of conservative judicial activism. I mean, it's activism, and it's conservative activism. And, because we're dealing with constitutional issues, a mere act of Congress cannot correct it. And that's why the hope that I see is that through the work of people like we have on this show, Tia in her reporting and Paula in her producing and Denise in her on the groundwork, that it's going to be the people themselves and say, hey, I want a voice again. And the way that that'll happen, that the only way that can happen, at least in law, is through a constitutional amendment. And it takes a lot to get one of those through, but We'll see.
Tia, is that close to what you were trying to accomplish here, getting that voice out?
Well, we wanted to document what was happening on the ground, and we hope that our film can be useful to organizations like Denise's Advancement Project that are working so hard to make, you know, to restore our democracy. We showed the film last week at the U.S. Senate, and two members of Congress, actually Senator Sanders and Representative Deutsch, who are sponsoring a constitutional amendment to essentially nullify Citizens United, had us up there and sponsored the screening in hopes that this film would help them, you know, educate the public. And we know that hundreds of communities around the country have passed resolutions advocating for a constitutional amendment. There are certainly other ways that folks are going about trying to change things. But we know that people are sick and tired. They're really fed up. And what I hope happens is that people get reengaged and make changes. But the other alternative is that people just get, you know, withdraw from the political process and feel, you know, more cynical than ever and more helpless than ever. I hope we don't let that happen.
And Denise and Richard, one thing, we just have about a minute and a half left before we have to end the show today, but one thing we didn't talk about, Missouri specifically, is the campaign contribution limits for individuals, which do not exist at the moment. One of the few states that has that. There is, I think you mentioned earlier in the show, though, Richard, that there's an effort to change that. What do you think about the possibility of that, going back on that change?
Missouri has gone back and forth on this. I think that right now we won't be seeing any movement back toward campaign finance regulation, especially if the U.S. Supreme Court, as I expect, begins chipping away at campaign contributions or federal entitlement to or you know, the federal authority for Congress to have campaign contributions. Missouri is already at where the Supreme Court wants to be.
Denise, what are your thoughts on it here in Missouri specifically?
Yeah, I defer to Professor Rubin on that.
Yeah. And Tia, how about you? Your thoughts on these campaign contributions, and again, is that what you're seeing from your film, that is where we're headed?
You mean the direct contributions?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, as Robert said, they're chipping away here. And look, I think it's important to point out that the Supreme Court, you know, is a very activist court, and Justice Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny Thomas, you know, ran one of these nonprofits that filtered this money. It's a very activist court, and it's a very, you know, politicized court. And I think these decisions really need to be questioned because of the lack of integrity of justices, particularly Justices Thomas and Scalia.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have. Thank you very much, Tia. And thank you for listening to Intersection. Thanks to our guest, Paula Elias, the co-director of the Citizen Jane Film Festival, Tia Lesson, Emmy Professor Richard Rubin, and Denise Lieberman, the senior attorney at the Advancement Project's Voter Protection Program. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar, Janet Saidi, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan's our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware, Casey Morell, and Andrew Yost. Paid Acres is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Ryan Mueller. Thanks for joining us.